This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Wade Chesterfield's a former minor league baseball player. Since he didn't have custody of his two daughters, he took matters into his own hands and kidnapped them from a foster home. Author Wiley Cash created Wade and his daughters and several other characters for his new book, This Dark Road to Mercy. Wiley Cash grew up in Gastonia, North Carolina, and that's the setting for his latest novel. He's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Durham in Chapel Hill tonight and Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow. But first, he is here in Durham to talk with us about This Dark Road to Mercy. Welcome back, Wiley Cash.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
This book, it's a page-turner. It moves. Lots of plot. Give us a summary. What's going on in this book?
Well, the easy summary, the elevator pitch is this book is about a washed-up minor league baseball player who kidnaps his two daughters from a foster home and tries to go on the run and be a dad even though it's too late.
We got three voices who are telling this who give us more than the elevator story. tell us about the three narrators in the book.
The first narrator is Wade's oldest daughter. Her name's Easter. She's 12 years old. She is world-wise and world-weary. She knows her dad is a complete loser, but she really wishes he wasn't. The second narrator is their court-appointed guardian ad litem. North Carolina has a wonderful system in social services for children who enter that system. They're appointed both a volunteer attorney, ad litem, and a volunteer from the community. And this ex-police officer's name is Brady Weller, and he is their volunteer guardian. And then the final narrator is named Pruitt. He's also an ex-minor league baseball player whose career was cut short when Wade threw a pitch and blinded him in his left eye. So
you set up a number of great paradoxes and perplexing and vexing themes. The idea of a father having to kidnap his daughters. I mean, you think about the concept of that. Now, how could that be? And then, but yeah, we do have laws to protect children, and the people who protect them are ex-cops with a history and a bit of guilt and a burden that they're carrying. And then bounty hunters who are legally authorized to go after the lawbreaker who kidnapped their own children, who themselves are brutes. And so you wonder kind of which side of the law we're on and where these boundaries get drawn, right?
Yeah, I think I don't like when things are too neat. You know, I like when readers don't quite know where to place their alliances, where they don't quite know who to trust or who to invest all their emotion in. And this is one of those kind of novels. I hope readers will leave this novel feeling as divided as they did when they began it. But I hope they'll be entertained, and I feel like they'll be closer to understanding something about the characters.
Well, here's the thing. You can. I mean, sometimes that sounds like, well, yeah, it's so ambiguous, I don't know what to do. But it's not, because you can leave it as divided as you started, but in whole new ways. And you're asked to see things in a new way and reconstruct some of your ideas, old ideas. And so while you may not have them all put together any better than you did before, it'll be new. And
certainly.
It'll be different.
Certainly.
And I think that's one of the things that happens here. So tell us a little bit about – what's great is this is also set in Gastonia. Mm-hmm. And – Sammy Sosa is referenced in this book.
He is. He actually played minor league baseball for the Gastonia Rangers before he was called up to Texas. A number of great major league players came through Gastonia. Pudge Rodriguez came through Gastonia and played for a while. Roman Gabriel actually owned the Gastonia Rangers.
Really?
For a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember going to a games as a kid and seeing him out front greeting fans. I mean, the Rangers stadium at Sims Field was like my Shea Stadium growing up. And now you kind of drive past it on I-85 and you think, man, how could I have ever thought that was this mecca of baseball? But to me, it was. And it just so happens that our hapless loser father, Wade Chesterfield, played for the Rangers around the same time as Sammy Sosa. And so this novel, my novel, which is set in the summer of 1998, Wade thinks that if he can make a sharper connection between himself and Sosa, his daughters will know that he wasn't always a loser.
And it's an amazing year, of course. Sammy Sosa, by the way, when he played for the Rangers, batted .312. I just wanted you to know that. He does go on to have a major league career. And, of course, in 98, he's in that home run duel with Mark McGwire, mm-hmm. right? And the sports world, the sporting world is riveted. And then later, the whole thing is tainted by the drug scandal, the enhancing drug scandal. How much of that is deliberate in your book? Because, again, the question of who's the hero, who's not, who we lionize in our innocence and what happens to that innocence when we are, you know, sort of shown the truth.
Yeah, you know, this isn't necessarily a baseball novel, but it does use baseball to raise what I hope are some interesting themes and ideas that readers will want to investigate. You know, 1998 was a really cynical time in American politics. We have a lot of scandal in the White House. We have scandals that will be coming soon and have just ended. We have the Branch Davidians in Waco. We have Elian Gonzalez down in Florida. We have all of these things going on. But regardless of what your political bent was, in the summer or late summer of 1998, we all sit down on our sofas every night because these guys were hitting monster home runs at a record pace, almost every other at bat. And so you knew if you watched Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, you were going to see history happen. And we all became fans, regardless of whether we liked baseball or not. And it saved the game. People came back to baseball. And then now we look back and we feel kind of silly for wearing those McGwire jerseys and wearing those, you know, Sosa hats. And we looked the other way when these guys' craniums were growing and their feet were growing into their 30s, you know. And we chose to not admit what was right in front of us. Well, sometimes we do that with families too. You know, we choose to believe things that we think we know or that we always hear about our fathers or our mothers or our grandparents. And then when we get older, we look back and we realize that wasn't true at all. I spent a great deal of my life misled.
Well, and one of the things that I think is wonderful about having at least part of the book narrated through Easter's eyes, the 12-year-old daughter, the older daughter, is that in a way, whatever you felt, right, whatever you thought about your dad or your baseball heroes or your political heroes, that's a real thing that exists in the world forever because you once thought it.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
And then there are these sort of facts that might accumulate later on. So what you do is examine my own consciousness and talk about birthing that, bringing that into the world. And once it's free and abroad, you don't really kill it just because you've learned something new, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's like what Faulkner says, the past isn't dead. It's not even past, you know. Yeah, yeah. The past affects us every single day. Every thought, which is, you know, true or not, it still affects us. And the stigma that we have of people on our lives, those things remain, and we suffer under the guilt of that burden, you know, especially when we're incorrect about how we feel about our parents or our grandparents or whoever the case may be. And what I love about Easter as a child narrator, you know, she tells you exactly what she thinks. She doesn't hold anything back. But throughout the novel, the reader can slowly see her begin to reassess her feelings. You know, when Wade does something heroic, it makes her heart race. But adults are much more protective of themselves and their emotions. An adult narrator, an adult Easter would never give Wade a chance. You know, she would have shut the door to him a long time ago. But a 12-year-old child who's in desperate need of love and attention and stability, she's going to look for that opening to believe in her dad again.
Well, and Brady Weller, another narrator, the ad litem in this, who's with Child Protective Services and trying to, I mean, his job is to get her back and to make her safe again. Here's a guy who's trying to reconstruct a past, who's maybe trying to make himself over, given his past.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's an ex-police detective with tragedy in his own past that was caused by his hand. And he's also suffering through a very estranged relationship with his high school daughter who's about to go to college. And so when these two girls go missing, he sees an opportunity to not only save them and rescue them, but maybe rescue some piece of his past or rescue some sense of himself in his daughter's eyes in terms of doing the right thing. If he can't do it for his daughter, maybe he can do it for someone else's.
Yeah, and again, you sort of open up this question of can we really remake ourselves or do we have to live with that old self? And, you know, you can be who you are now, but
yeah,
you can't not be who you were then.
And something interesting, you know, we think that, you know, we assume that whatever is the law, that is what is right, especially in terms of children. But Brady has to come up with some hard decisions about what's best for these girls, you know. Is it following the law or is it doing something else?
Particularly when he's wrestling with becoming a good dad in his children's
sure.
eyes and begins to identify a little more closely with Wade's predicament.
Sure, absolutely.
And then there's Pruitt, who has a legal right to do what he's doing, and he's just, you know, utterly brutish. Tell us about the third narrator.
Well, yeah. So one of the reasons that Wade kidnaps his two daughters is because he's found some cash that he shouldn't have his hands on. And Robert Pruitt is hired to get that cash back. And he wants to do it because there's a payday at the end of it, but there's also a little revenge at the end of it. He's been looking for Wade Chesterfield for quite a while. He's been upset with Wade for quite a while. And I wanted the reader to feel, because Pruitt's narration is in first person, and I wanted Pruitt to feel like a great white shark that is trolling the ocean for prey. I wanted his eyes to be blacked out. I wanted his gaze to be expressionless. I wanted his narration to be flat. And that's how he is. And But perhaps there are moments in the book where the reader kind of identifies with him and says, I know, I understand why you're mad. If somebody ruined my career and blinded me, I'd go after them too. And I wanted the reader to come up against that discomfort because I think it's fun making readers uncomfortable.
How do you work at that, or do you have to work at that to have these three narrators and these three voices? Do you have to keep going back over them and say, no, flatter, flatter, flatter?
You do. You know, with Pruitt, I did something really interesting. You know, I don't believe in method writing or any more than I believe in method acting. You know, you just sit down and do your work, or you go on stage and do your work. But with Pruitt, the first go around in his narration, I took all of his self-reflexive pronouns out. In the first drafts, he never said the word I. He never referred to himself in the first person. And so that selfhood was removed. And so what I was hoping was that readers would see him almost as a shape, you know, not necessarily as a defined state of a person or a defined being. And I thought that would make him a little chillier and a little colder and a little more distant, a little bit farther removed from the reader's experience. So that was really fun. But for Easter, her voice, you know, when I was writing my first novel, A Land More Kind Than Home, it took 5 years to sell it, to finish it, to have it come out. You know, I had all this rejection, and I thought I had a failed book. So I started thinking about another novel, and Easter's voice came to me, and I heard it plain as day, crystal clear. You know, her voice was always really, really strong for me. But Brady's voice, I had to put myself in the position of somebody who's made a lot of bad decisions and is having to deal with those decisions and find a way back to who he wants to be.
Talking to Wiley Cash, his second novel is This Dark Road to Mercy, going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight and at Quail Ridge tomorrow. So you've got three narrators. You're trying to keep them together. You're listening to these voices. And the stories are in some ways loosely connected to real events in Gastonia, one of them a well-known robbery. So tell us about the Loomis heist.
The Loomis heist in Charlotte was an interesting time for Gastonia. You know, I think it was an interesting time for North Carolina, period, because we still had Eric Rudolph running around the woods up in the western part of the state. We have the largest bank heist in American history taking place in Charlotte. The money's found in Gastonia. And so we have all of this kind of panic and this seeming lawlessness just west of Charlotte. And I think something of the book comes out of that. That sense of lawlessness, that sense of not being able to figure out who the bad guys are or if they're really even bad guys necessarily, because Rudolph had a lot of help up there in the mountains. You know, these guys who pulled off this bank heist, I think by the time they were all arrested, I think like 30-something people were arrested, you know, because so many people in the community were involved in it. And this book is a community book. It's, you know, it's based on these, loosely based on these historical things that actually happened. But I like to go back and mind the geography of my own past and my own childhood and say, how can I make fiction from this? Charles Chestnut, a North Carolina writer, said most fiction is the power of rearranging your memory. And I think that's true.
And there's also a personal connection. You knew two little girls.
I did. Yeah, I grew up, as you said, in Gastonia. When I was growing up, when I was 15, there were two foster children who went to my church. They were being raised by an older couple in the church. And when they were 15 and 13, they went back to live with their birth mother and ended up being murdered by two guys they were dating who were much older. The 15-year-old's boyfriend was in his 20s, and the 13-year-old's boyfriend was in his 30s, and they accused the two girls of stealing from them, and they murdered them at Crowder's Mountain near where I grew up. And that tragedy always stayed with me, the loss of those girls who were just exceptional, nice, quiet girls who never bothered anybody, but they never had a chance. And I always wondered, if I were to create two young foster children, what kind of chances would they have? You know, how could their lives be different, maybe?
Well, so
who'd have to step in to save them?
And so they have this life in this book. Were you thinking about being a writer at the time? I'm just wondering how that story worked on your imagination.
You know, like a lot of people who become writers, either professionally or you know, in their private lives, I grew up listening to The Doors, thinking nobody understood me, writing these doomy, self-centered poems and these spiral-bound journals and coffee shops. And then I began, you know, being interested in narrative poetry. And then I began reading a lot of fiction. And it wasn't long before I tried to write fiction. And in the 10th grade, I decided to go to UNC Asheville because they had a degree in creative writing. So I set my sights on UNCA, and I never looked back.
Will you read for us?
Absolutely. This comes earlier in the book. The novel opens with Easter playing kickball after school with the kids in the foster home that she lives with. And she looks up and sees Wade sitting in the stands, and he's been gone for years. And she thinks, why are you here? So this is a conversation between the two of them. Why are you here? I asked. Wade sighed and raised his eyes and looked toward the outfield. And then he looked down at me. I heard about what happened to y'all's mother, he said. You heard today? No, not today, he said. A while ago. A while ago meaning you should have come to her funeral? What little bit of one she had? A while ago meaning you should have come and checked on us before now? Before they put us in a home? No, he said. Not that long ago. Just long enough to do nothing, I said. Nothing until now? Until now? Just saying that made me laugh. I unfolded my arms and turned to walk back to the bench. Hold on, Easter, he said. Talk to me for 1 minute. Just 1 minute. He'd taken his hands out of his pockets and grabbed hold of the chain links in the fence. I gotta take the field, I said. And even as I said it, I thought it sounded like something somebody might say in a movie right before something good or something bad happened to let you know whether the ending was going to be a happy one or not.
Wiley Cash reading from his latest novel, This Dark Road to Mercy. He's going to read more tonight at Flyleaf Books and tomorrow at Quail Ridge Books. And congratulations, by the way, you won the Crook's Corner Award.
I did. It was the inaugural Crook's Corner Book Prize for debut novel set in the South, and A Land More Kind Than Home won it. So it was a real thrill and a real treat. And I'm actually having dinner tonight at Crook's Corner with the Orange County Literacy Council. When I'm in North Carolina, I like to partner with literacy councils throughout the state to raise awareness and raise funds for the literacy rates in North Carolina, which are despairingly, the illiteracy rates are too high for us, for such an educated state. So I'll be at Crook's tonight enjoying my free glass of wine. That's what comes with the prize.
Well, you know, Bill Smith is always looking for great ways to nourish our bodies and our minds. So this prize is something to look forward to year after year. Congratulations to you and Orange County Literacy. You know, it's kind of an amazing thing to think about how far we need to go in education and literacy. Orange County Literacy, of course, has done a great job.
They have. You know, consistently, North Carolina illiteracy rates hover somewhere around 10 to 12%, especially over the last decade. So that means 10 to 12% of adults in North Carolina can't read prescription medication information on their bottles. They can't read rental agreements. They can't write letters of complaint. They can't read to their children. They can't read their children's homework. And so many of us grew up with parents and grandparents who read to us, and so many of us read to our children and to our grandchildren. And I can't imagine not being able to do that. And I also can't imagine the bravery it takes for an adult to admit that he or she is struggling with literacy. And so I think the applause and the congratulations needs to go to both those who offer means to an end in terms of literacy, and also those who are willing to come into these centers and ask for help. It's really a heroic act.
It's great to have these nonprofits available, and of course in a place like Orange County where you have UNC Chapel Hill, you're expecting more of that kind of effort. And then at the policy level, you know, we have to do something for those other underserved parts of our state that don't have universities and great writers around. Of course, North Carolina's probably got more working full-time writers than any other state per capita in the nation. So we've got, you know, in terms of literacy and in terms of literature, a lot to boast about. But bringing up our whole state, particularly those rural areas, we got a lot to work for.
Absolutely.
Wiley, it is always a pleasure. You will be back for your next novel because you're living in Wilmington now.
I am, yeah. My wife and I moved down to Wilmington in November. We're finally back in the state after 10 years.
Can you write about it if you're here?
You know, I hope so. I hope I can, you know. I wrote my first novel, Living in Louisiana, A Land More Kind Than Home, and I wrote This Dark Road to Mercy, Living in West Virginia. So
we might have to kick you out for a few months just to get your third novel. But you'll be back, and that's
good. I
will,
thank you.
Wiley Cash, author of This Dark Road to Mercy, Flyleaf Books tonight in Chapel Hill, 7 o'clock, Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tomorrow at 7:30. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk to a Brazilian filmmaker about the myth of racial equality in Brazil. Stay tuned.